Okay, you have a handout there. I'm not going to do very much with it except to draw attention to what it is. This is what Vern and I were going to do together one of these sessions today. We worked this up for the International Hymn Society meeting in Bethlehem last summer, Bach and Hymnody, we did together, and this was his, we worked on this together. What this basically is that the examples of Bach's use of the chorale that are somewhat unusual. And when you talk about the Bach chorale, inevitably you think of the use of the chorale in the cantata at the end, or sometimes in the middle, but usually at the end, and in the Passions. But there is a whole sort of hidden world of not only cantata texts, not only chorale texts, but also chorale melodies that are used to within the fabric of the music. And here is an attempt just to put together, just almost at random, some of the phrases that Vernon and I have picked up where a text or melody is being quoted. And you really need to hear some of these, and I can't sing as well as Vernon can, but at least you can read the musical examples and see how the, for example, the first example in Cantata 93, to see how the opening fugal writing there grows out of the melody that the cantus firmus that the full choir sing together. And that is a typical thing in Bach. The chorale cantatas, the cantus firmus is the chorale melody, but the way in which the underparts of the chorus and also the instrumental accompaniment is usually crafted out of that basic melody, certainly the incipit of that melody. The second example is of a straightforward, what looks like a straightforward chorale, and then you find that it is punctuated by a recitative which in some way comments on the cantata, the chorale text. The next example, 3 from Christlag and Todes Banden, there are examples of how the basic melody, the tenor entry and also the soprano, but especially the tenor entry, is crafted out of the basic melody of Christlag and Todes Banden. And there are, when you go home on the plane or in the car, if someone else is driving, that is, look at these examples and just play them through and just see. But let me refer to the last page and the very last example, because I think that a lot of work needs to be done on the recitatives of the cantatas, because I think there we are going to find hidden away in the text and in the melody of the recitatives particularly, we're going to find quotations of chorales, and this is one that I've come across. It's in Cantata 22, and what is significant about the Cantata 22, which you ought to know by now? Jesus took to him the 12. It's an Esto Mihi Sunday, and it was the one of his trial cantatas which he took to Leipzig on the 23rd, in February 1723. So it is a trial cantata, and in the in a recitative for bass, strings, and basso continuo, the words of that suddenly occur in the libretto are "Es war eine feste Burg auf Tabors." So you have a textual reference to "Ein feste Burg." So if you look at the melody, da 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 da, just very small and passing, but just a neat little reference, which is not only textual, but it's also a musical reference to the melody. Now, I firmly believe that if we look very carefully, we will find more such associations embedded in the Cantata text. The point is that no one until recently has even bothered to look for such associations, and that's something that Vernon, I know, is very keen on, and when he gets some time, he wants to explore that area further. But that's really for your information, just to look at the variety of ways in which Bach incorporates the text and melodies into his cantatas. What I want to... when do I stop, by the way? Is it 3:30? Do we make a break at 3:30? No break. No break. Okay. Bach... to look at Bach and hymnody during the middle years, shall we say, in Leipzig, that is getting towards the last quarter of his life. Now, the year following his appointment, he was appointed in 1723, the year following there was a very interesting book that appeared in Leipzig, and it was called Geistreicher Liederschatz, Spiritual Lieder Treasury, oder Leipziger Gesangbuch, Leipzig Hymn Book, wherein is to be found the basic corpus of all evangelical, and evangelical in these terms, in German terms, means Lutheran songs, which are especially used in Leipzig and other places, and used within the worship. Third edition, Leipzig, 1724. Just exactly what the earlier two editions were, we're not quite sure. They don't appear to exist anymore. But it was published in 1724, that is, the year after Bach had arrived in Leipzig. And the hymn book contains about 260 German hymns, but it also includes some Latin texts, such as Credo in Unum Deum, the Creed. It also includes Kyrie, Gloria, Magnificat, and so on. It also includes the text of a motet by Jakob Handel, also known as Gallus, which was sung in the Leipzig churches on Palm Sunday, and on Good Friday, the motet Ecce Quemode Moritor Justus. And at the end of this hymn book is to be found an appendix in four sections, Anhungen, as I was saying this morning. First, there is the account of the Passion of Jesus from St. Matthew's Gospel, chapters 26 and 27, used on as the Gospel for Palm Sunday, and it's followed by the equivalent from St. John's Gospel, chapters 13, 18, and 19, the Gospel for Good Friday. That is the passages set by Bach in his two great passions. And then the third part is Bugenhagen's Harmony of the Passion from the Four Gospels. And the fourth is Bugenhagen's edited account of the destruction of the city of Jerusalem in AD 70. I think it's on Trinity 10, the 10th Sunday after Trinity, that in the morning the Gospel of the day deals with the Jesus' prediction of the destruction of the temple, not one stone will lie upon another. And it was customary in the afternoon at the Vespers service to complement the gospel message of the day, to complement that with the reading of the account from Josephus, as edited by Bugenhagen, Flavius Josephus, the Jewish historian, where he gives an account of the destruction of Jerusalem at the hands of the Romans. And that was read on the 10th Sunday after Trinity, and it's a very graphic and very moving account. So in the morning, for the Gospel of the day, you hear our Lord's prophecy of the destruction of Jerusalem. In the afternoon at the Vesper service, you actually read, and hear read, rather, the account of that destruction as recorded by Josephus and as edited by Bugenhagen, who was a right-hand man of Luther in Wittenberg in the 16th century. Now, in the...
I guess we're all aware of the little hymn book that we had in our church fund back over here. My dad, my mother, they had
The German hymnal, the what's it called, the Gesangbuch für, I can't remember, but it's the hymn book for the Church of the Unaltered Augsburg Confession, the Volta hymnal, yeah. Which just illustrates that the that hymnals always contain, at this time anyway, more than hymns. Now, in the library for Bibliothek für Musikgeschichte in Leipzig, there is a manuscript which has the title Handwritten List of Leipzig Hymn Books, mostly in the hand of one Friedrich Gottlob Hoffmann, and it dates from 1762. And it's therefore a useful guide to the hymn books of this university town, many of which Bach would have known and used and would have had in his possession, even though they're not represented in the specification of his library. It's a brief document, and it classifies its short title listing under three main headings. For church use, one, for church use, two, for private use, and three, what it calls Choral Melodienbücher, that is, melody books, melody and choral books, that is, music books. And under the second heading, there is included the following title, Christliche Liederschatz oder Leipziger Gesangbuch, Leipzig 1717, which clearly must be the first edition, which doesn't exist, of this 1724, which is the third edition. Now, what is interesting is that the manuscript classifies it as a hymnal for private use. And that's somewhat surprising, since the title page states quite clearly that it is it contains hymns which are sung in the worship services of Leipzig and other churches. But it's important to realize that at this stage there was no official Leipziger Gesangbuch. There was no official hymn book for Leipzig other than the Neue Leipziger Gesangbuch of Gottfried Vopelius, issued in 1682. But that book was essentially a book for the choir. It was not a congregational book. It contained all the music for the versicles and responses, the Sanctus, Kyrie and Gloria in straightforward plain song, and also for festal use with the versicles and responses, the Sursum Corda, with a setting of six parts for choir. It's rather splendid stuff. And there is no modern edition of it, so you can't perform it. However, I hope to do something about that one of these days. Therefore, the Geistliche Liederschatz, this hymnal, is therefore a private hymnal in the sense that it had no official church sanction, and therefore it doesn't have on the title page the term privilegiert, that is, licensed. Officially licensed. Yet it was for church use in that it contained the hymnody regularly sung in the Leipzig churches, but it was unofficial. If you needed a hymn book, then this would be useful to take along with you, but it was in no way officially produced. There was one officially produced in 1735, and if you look in the display as you go into the left cabinet as you go into the library, you will see that there is a copy of that official hymnal, 1735, really quite late. Before then, people used all sorts of hymnals, but this one was designed for, it was a private venture to provide the congregation, if they needed it, because most of it was memorized anyway, here was the opportunity, again a publisher taking the opportunity with a hymn book. Now, if you compare the 1724 book with the one of Vopelius, which was issued some 32 years earlier, then the one thing that you notice straight away is the expanded use of the hymns of Paul Gerhardt. In 1682, in the official, the choral hymn book used in Leipzig, only two Gerhardt texts have found a place. They are Nun Ruhen aller Wälder and Wach auf mein Herz und Singe. Now Bach knew both of these and knew them well. The first he was to have been included in the his projected Orgelbuchlein, though it was never, he never got round actually to do it, And the second one was used in the cantata 194, which was used for the dedication at the dedication of the organ in Sturmtal, a little tiny little village, on the 2nd of November 1723. And at every Bach festival in Leipzig, and this certainly happened last year, always there's a trip out to Sturmtal for not only to visit the church, but also to hear the cantata 194 actually in the church. By the time you've got everybody to sing in there, there's not a lot of room for many people, but it's beautiful. Falling apart, but beautiful, the church. Now, in the 1724 hymnal for private, in quotation marks, use, there are 12 or more hymn texts by Gerhardt. And nine of these hymns, appear in cantatas and passions and motets that Bach composed during his first 10 years or so of his appointment in Leipzig. I won't give them to you, but I have them here. And that is when Paul Gerhardt first published his hymns, they were not immediately taken up in the regular hymnals and in use. It took a little time for them actually to become accepted. But that was what was happening elsewhere. They were using them before. But in Leipzig, it was in the 1720s, when during Bach's time, that the hymnody of Paul Gerhardt actually got into use during the worship. And Bach's growing use of Gerhardt's hymns during the first 10 years or so of his cantorate in Leipzig reflects both the expanding corpus of hymnody sung by the congregations in Leipzig, but also it shows Bach encountering what was, in a sense, the new development, or one of the new developments in hymnody that was taking place at that time. Now, that Bach should be keeping up with such developments in practical hymnody, where the hymns of the later 17th century were taking their place alongside, not replacing, but taking their place alongside, the earlier hymns by Luther and others, we should carefully note this. Since the view persists that the older Bach became, the more he returned to using the classic hymns of the Reformation period. You'll find that view expressed again and again. And the opinion is one that is based on the chronology of Bach's composition, as you'll find it constructed by Philipp Spitta in the later 19th century. Now, it was Spitta's conclusion, purely on stylistic grounds, that the chorale cantatas, which mainly employ the 16th century hymns as their basis, he said that they date from Bach's later years in Leipzig, okay, on stylistic grounds. But the researches of von Dadelson and Dürr in the 1950s, based on watermarks and handwriting styles and so on, these men have established that the most of these chorale cantatas were in fact written in the second year of Bach's cantorate, that is during 1724-25. And therefore, assessments based on Spitta's conclusions are no longer valid. And instead of withdrawing into the Reformation chorale in his later years, as Spitta suggested, we find that Bach was much more creative in his approach to hymnody. Now, he certainly retained his appreciation of the older Reformation hymnody. He never wavered and moved away from it, as you can see that his canonic variations on Vom Himmel Hoch, which were 1747, towards the end of his life. But at the same time, in these mature years, he also made increasing use of more contemporary hymnody. Now, Alfred Dürr, in a very important essay, he's one of the editors of the Neue Bachausgabe and one of the leading authorities on the music of Bach. In an essay which was published here in America, indeed it was an essay in the volume, the Festschrift, that was dedicated to Walter Bozin, the professor of liturgics here, he stated that in a very important essay, that the chorale cantatas show how closely tradition and modern writing go hand in hand in Bach's work. It would be advisable to ask cautiously whether Bach himself, in the course of his life, was not exposed to a change, and in the 1730s turned his interest to an increasing degree to the chorale output of his own time. Already in the Christmas Oratorio, he continues, the hymnody of the 17th century outweighs that of the Reformation period. End of quote. There are therefore two strands of hymnody which we need to investigate in relation to Bach. Firstly, his knowledge and use of both traditional hymnody and what was then contemporary hymnody. And the evidence is that while he began, naturally enough, as we saw this morning with the Orgelbuchlein, where he began with the older hymns and never lost his respect for them, he also kept up with new developments then being made in hymnody. Now, as I say, his approach to the traditional hymnody, you can see that in the Orgelbuchlein, which we looked at this morning, and also you can see that in the Klavierübung part 3, which deals mainly with Luther's hymns, the catechism hymns, and the, not all, yes, Allein Gott und der Herr sei er, and Kyrie Gott Vater, and so on. But all hymns from the 16th century, the old basic liturgical stuff and catechism stuff. So that's around 1713, the other one's around 1739. Here is demonstrated his concern for the classic hymnody of the of the Lutheran Church. And a similar concern can be detected in the recently discovered chorale preludes at Yale, the 32. They are basically on hymns that date from the middle, no later than the middle of the 17th century. Another link between Bach and traditional hymnody is found in Ammerbach's Orgel oder Instrument Tablatur book, organ or instrument tablature book. That is, you know what tablature is? It's cryptic code music, music in letters rather than notation. Published in Leipzig in 1571. And we know that Bach owned no less than three copies of this. Two are now in England, one in the British Library, London, the other in Cambridge University Library, and one of them is in the Stadtbibliothek in Leipzig. Now, the implication is that Bach used this particular collection of the former organist at the Thomaskirche in Leipzig, and he did so. He used it for teaching his organ students. You can see the point. I mean, he needed to have multiple copies so that each student could retain one for his studies. Now, what is significant that this collection of various kinds of keyboard pieces in tablature includes a few settings of hymn melodies. And in six important instances, the setting which Ammerbach gives are based on polyphonic vocal models. Now, in recent years, a very fine practical edition of Ammerbach has been published, edited by Charles Jacobs, published by OUP, Oxford University Press. But unfortunately, the editor doesn't seem to be aware of a dissertation by Harlan McConnell, and therefore he does not note all these vocal models on which these six are based. These vocal models based on hymn tunes. And there are six of them. One of them is a reduction of, they're all reductions of vocal settings of chorales. One is from the 1551 edition of Walter's Chorgesangbuch. Two are from Le Maistre's Gesangbuch, Wittenberg, 1556, and a few other ones published in various places. Now, that's very interesting. So you get the point. What within Ammerbach, in tablature form, for keyboard use, are polyphonic settings of chorales which are reduced into short score. Okay? And as this dissertation makes very clear, Amerbach's versions are very little different from the vocal models, except that in some instances some degree of keyboard ornamentation has been added. Now this is very interesting, that here in Bach's study book with his students, here, for example, there was one setting by Walter himself. And what it means is that we don't know whether Bach was aware of that or not, because Amerbach does not indicate where he pinched the stuff from in the first place. But nevertheless, these keyboard versions of the 16th century chorale motets provided for Bach a direct line of continuity with the roots of the Lutheran chorale tradition. It was part of his teaching material, and it reaches way back to the time of Luther and Johann Walter. And indeed, many of the opening movements, as this week I hope you've begun to learn, many of the opening movements of the chorale cantatas, 64 is one, well, it isn't a chorale cantata, but no, you haven't been doing a chorale cantata this week. However, never mind. But if you look at the chorale cantatas, at the opening movements, you can see that they are a logical conclusion and a culmination of the style of these older polyphonic settings of the sturdy hymns of the Reformation time. There's a direct link between the two, and it's very interesting that we now know that the book that he used with his organ students reaches way back into that tradition. So that's on the one hand, that is the traditional hymnody, which we know very much about Bach. But let's turn and to look at what was the contemporary hymnody in Bach's day. And the primary witness for to his concern for contemporary hymnody is the so-called Schemeli Gesangbuch. Schemeli makes no content and makes no comment upon its aroma. It's called Schemeli after its editor, Georg Christian Schemeli, whose father had been a pupil of Bach. Musikalisches Gesangbuch, published in Leipzig in 1736. And Bach himself acted as the musical consultant. Now here is a congregational hymn book which reflects the movement towards a freer type of hymnody begun by the collections of Freilinghausen at the beginning of the 18th century. Freilinghausen is the hymnal which is usually referred to as the pietistic hymnal, published in 1704 and the second part in 1714. But it's clear that the freer type of melody affected Orthodox circles as well, and there is no doubt that the Schemeli Gesangbuch is an Orthodox production. For example, this hymn book contains the hymns of such contemporaries of Bach as Valentin Ernst Löscher, L-O-Umlaut S-C-H-E-R, and Erdmann Neumeister. Both men noted for their orthodoxy, Lutheran orthodoxy, but also both men noted for their warm devotional poetry. But it is a very well-balanced book. It also it does contain all the old stuff, but it contains a lot of new stuff. For example, the Schemeli Gesangbuch contains virtually all the hymns of Paul Gerhardt, together with other writers of his time, as well as the 16th century classics of Luther and his circle. So it's a very rich anthology of hymnody. Now, apart from the 69 melodies which it contains, the 69 melodies which were edited by Bach, and they are engravings, not set on music type. Apart from these 69 melodies, the collection itself has been largely ignored in Bach research. And many have assumed that the only musical interest is in these 69 melodies. However, the title, Musikalisches Gesangbuch, seems to imply that the musical aspects of the hymnody have received close attention throughout the whole of the collection. And that is true, because only a superficial examination of the volume will confirm this point, because you'll find that as the hymns are set out, they're given each hymn is given a number, and to the left of this hymn number, and before the title of the associated melody to which you should sing it, there is an uppercase letter, G, F, D, C, A, or whatever it happens to be. And it's clear that these are the recommended key for the respective melody. So although it only contains 69 melodies for something like 700 hymns, actually in notation, it gives you the name of the hymn, of the tune that you are to sing this hymn to, and it gives you the key, the desired key in which to play it. Now, if so, then it means that it represents, we know that Bach was the musical editor, or the musical, at least the musical consultant for the book. Therefore, this must represent Bach's own suggestions as which is the most desirable key to sing these tunes in. And similarly, if Bach was the consultant, then we can expect him to have been conscientious about examining the text and tune marriages in the book. But until recently, this has been a largely explored area, but people are beginning to look at this to see which of the tunes are called for more often. And therefore, as it were, you can begin to pull out a kind of top 10 tunes that are recommended for these, or however many you like to choose, the top 20, of the tunes that are used throughout the book. Now, the implication is that the 69 melodies that the book does include are lesser-known melodies. Because all the well-known melodies that are called for, Nun kommt der Heidenheiland, Ein fester Burg, are not given in notation. And the implication is, well, you know all about these, and you can play them, you know where to find them. And it does seem that for when the book was being prepared, that Bach did provide tunes, all the other tunes that were necessary. But that for economic reasons, Breitkopf, the publisher, withdrew the familiar tunes. Okay? Because they would be known, they're not really needed, it's only the 69 that are a little bit unfamiliar, these are the ones that we will concentrate on. And therefore, it would seem that 200 tunes 200 tunes have been lost, because in the preface the Breitkopf says that he has to hand some 200 melodies which are not included because they are very well known. So it sounds as if for economic reasons Rodney Schrank knows all about publishing and how publishers have to make such decisions for economic reasons, that he decided that, well, music is inexpensive. And Breitkopf, the publishing house, hadn't been going that long at this stage. It was early. It was one of the earliest. He published all kinds of other things. And this was one of his earliest music publications. And he didn't want to burn his fingers financially, so kept the 200 to one side. And therefore, in theory, there should be 200 figured bass melodies somewhere by Bach, which have been lost, presumably. However, the preface goes on to indicate the willingness of the publisher to consider a second edition which would include all these melodies should there be sufficient demand for an enlarged edition. There was no such demand. There was no second edition. There is, however, an interesting entry in the New Year catalogue of Breitkopf in 1764. It says, Johann Sebastian Bach, a chorale book with notes, with the melodies set, with General Bass, figured bass, 240 of them in Leipzig use. Sounds very much like the missing 200. It was Charles Sanford Terry who made the observation in 1928 that the title here suggests that it contains the settings prepared by Bach for the Schemmelle Gesangbuch. But that title never appeared in print. You can't look in a bibliography and find what the catalogue is referring to. And it well may be that Breitkopf was offering for sale manuscript copies of these figure-based chorales rather than advertising a forthcoming publication. That he had these chorales, and if people wanted them, then he would issue them in manuscript form. Now, we know that a collection of the 100 of the four-part chorales were published in 1765 and a second 100 in 1769. But these were from another publisher, not from Breitkopf. And although the title page claimed the authority of C.P.E. Bach, C.P.E. Bach had nothing to do with them, and he disowned them. C.P.E. then sought out to bring a more authentic edition of the four-part chorales, which eventually he did with Breitkopf between 1784 and 1787. However, not all the melodies prepared for Schemmelle have necessarily been lost, because, again, as Terry has suggested, that some of these may well have found their way into the CPE collection, manuscript collection, and had their figured basses realized by CPE Bach, and were later included in the editions of the four-part chorales. Now, of the 69 melodies that occur in the Schemmelle Gesangbuch, one can say that, taking the implication of the comments in the preface for the book, that they were less well known, and therefore taken together they are a measure of the newness of the collection. Now, in general, these tunes are, in the words of the title page, they are Arian rather than Lieder. These new tunes are arias rather than hymns, as we would think of them. That is, they are soloistic and personal rather than congregational and corporate hymns. Two of these melodies date from the 16th century, from the French metrical Psalter, 22 from the later 17th century, 12 from Freilinghausen Part 1, 1704, 7 from Freilinghausen Part 2, 1714, and 4 from various printed sources between 1715 and 1727. And that leaves 22 melodies which have no earlier printed source than the Schemmelle Gesangbuch, that is 1736. One of them is directly ascribed to S. Bach, D.M., Director of Music, Lipsiensis, Leipzig, and it is described as an aria, vergiss mein nicht. How many of the remainder are by Bach is an open question. Dear, dear Jehovah will ich singen can be regarded as most likely by Bach, since it appears also in manuscript form in the notebook for Anna Magdalena Bach. Two others have a strong claim to being by Bach, appear in an appendix, and they're very interesting indeed. Both of them are associated with texts by Valentin Ernst Lerscher, and were originally published in a devotional book some 20 years or so earlier, Dresden, 1713. Now, what is interesting about these texts for which this music is provided is that the author, Lerscher, wrote them in connection with older hymns, and he directed that the stanzas of his hymns should alternate with those of the associated older text. So Lerscher writes a hymn text and says, but sing this stanza after the first stanza of this older hymn. Then you sing my first stanza, then you sing the second stanza of the older hymn, then you sing my second one, and so on through in alternation. So you have a commentary on the old by the new. You have the older hymn with its older melody, you have the newer hymn with its newer melody. You have the older hymn, which is very much congregational, and you have a newer hymn, which is very soloistic, which gives you the opportunity of alternating congregational and solo, congregation and solo. So you have the old hymnody and the new hymnody together. And what Bach has done is to provide music for Lersch's text. Now, number 936, sorry, I underestimated the numbers, there are nearly 1,000 hymns in this book. 936, the Lersch's text, is Kommt Seelen dieser Tag, which you probably know, and it has its Bachian melody. But if you look at the rubric very carefully, it tells you how this is to be sung. You are to sing Luther's hymn, Komm Gott Schöpfer für Heiliger Geist, Come Creator, Creator Spirit. You are to sing the first verse of Luther's hymn. Then, Komm Seelen dieser Tag, the first stanza. Then you sing the second stanza of Luther's hymn. Then you sing the other. And here you have a very new direction in hymnody that Bach is associated with. Here Bach takes Lersch at his word and provides a new form of hymnody, the old and the new combined together. And he does exactly the same with Lersch's text, Kommt wieder aus der finsten Gruft, is put alongside Heut triumphiert Gottes Zorn. And these two examples are very interesting indeed. And if you want to be able to approach them now, is that it is now possible, because in a publication of the Royal School of Church Music, which is available over here, I think Hinshaw is the agent, last year John Wilson brought out a little booklet. Is it 21 hymns, old and new, for use as anthems? He has provided an English version of the two juxtaposed hymns, the old and the new together, and it works extremely well, very well indeed. But it is a very clear demonstration of Bach actually using the old and the new together. And then, of course, there are the four-part chorales of Bach, and quite a lot of new work or new discoveries are being made with regard to the four-part chorales. For example, there is a new one in quotation marks that's been discovered, a four-part setting of Ein fester Burg. It comes from what Christoph Wolff calls the interim version of Cantata 80, which Bach wrote in 1723. Basically what happened was that it depends who you speak to, but I think what happened is that Bach composed Cantata 80, that massive chorus, but he had trouble with it, or rather his singers had trouble with it, you know, the opening chorus from Cantata 80, without the trumpets and timpani, of course, because they were added by Wilhelm Friedemann Bach. They are unauthentic, and if you try to do Cantata 80 with trumpets and timpani, any of you done it? Well, if you try and do it, I can guarantee that the rehearsal will fall apart at one point, and I can tell you where it will fall apart. Because usually trumpets and timpani are always synchronized, right? Well, if you look very carefully at the score, there is one place where the timpani comes in one measure before the trumpets. And of course the timpanist only has his part in front of him, or her, and all the way through. I mean, you know, psychologically, a timpanist will not play without a trumpet. And because trumpet and timpani just go together, and I can guarantee that when that point comes for the first time, they will all fall apart, because the timpanist will think, I've miscounted, I've come in too soon. But that's what it says on the score. But I think the score is wrong. And I think that whoever copied the score from the parts made the mistake. Clearly the timpani and the trumpet should go together anyway. But anyway, it's by Wilhelm Friedemann Bach, so they shouldn't be played at all. It's an addition, and you can hear that it doesn't really fit. Now, there is a problem with it, of course, because there is a canon five octaves apart and one measure apart. Five octaves this way, one measure that way. And in the original score, it is just an oboe with a continuo underneath. And I think that if you have large resources, that is not going to work. because the oboe does not come through. And that's why Friedemann Bach reinforces the oboe with a trumpet, then thinks he will add two more trumpets plus timpani. And it's clearly demonstrable that the parts are only in Wilhelm Friedemann's hand. But Bach didn't have such large resources available to him. Anyway, what I think happened was that he wrote this massive contrapuntal monument and his choir couldn't do it. They were having trouble with it. So instead of that chorus, he put it on one side until later. And instead, that the second form of cantata 80 begins in 1715. It's a Weimar cantata. Bits and pieces of it are a Weimar cantata. And instead of the opening, large opening chorus, he started it with a four-part chorale. So the second version of it begins with a four-part chorale and ends with a four-part chorale. And this has only recently come to light because some nitwit in the 19th century had more money than sense, or wanted more money than sense. Had the first page of the score and tore it twice. So he had three parts and sold the three parts. Or maybe he gave the three parts away, I don't know. And one part went to Leningrad, one part went to, I think, either Brussels or Paris, and the other part was lost. But the other part came up in an auction room and is the missing link. And putting the three parts together, photographically, they've never been reunited. One part is in Princeton now. The formerly lost part is now found and is in Princeton. And we now have this four-part chorale complete, and it is very interesting indeed. So another one is there. So all the time we're adding to the. So you can't talk. Was it however many Riemenschneider? Was it 371 Bach chorales? The total is now increased, at least by one, and probably by another 30. Because in 1984, yet another manuscript connection of chorales turned up in an antiquarian bookshop in Germany. And this is another exciting find, because it contains 126 four-part chorales, numbered 101 to 226, and it's in the hand of Christian Friedrich Penzel, P-E-N-Z-E-L, who is known to be the most faithful of transcribers of the music of Bach. Several of the cantatas that we have are known to us only in copies made by Penzel, so this is rather exciting. It has no title page, so we don't know what Penzel's object was in compiling the manuscript, but since the items are numbered from 101 onwards, it looks as though he thought of it as complementing the first part of the collection published by Bernstiel in 1765. Now, significantly, 32 of these four-part chorale settings have never before appeared in print. All the others are clearly Bach's. And by implication, these other 32 are by Bach. But they were published in last year by Bernreiter in an edition edited by Wolfgang Wiemer. Two of these 32 appear in other manuscripts, and the classification is as follows by Wiemer. Firstly, there are two spiritual songs, undoubtedly by Bach, both the melodies and the four-part settings. Denket doch ihr Menschen Kinder and Welt tober wie du willst. And since the Schimmelige Gesangbuch, the first is in the Schimmelige Gesangbuch but connected with another melody, and the second doesn't appear in Schimmelig at all, they are presumably to be dated after 1736, and therefore is an indication of Bach continuing to be interested in the developing hymnody. Then there are around 12 realizations of the figured bass of Schimmelig melodies. 12 of them are given in realized form and look as though they are Bach's own realizations of his own figured bass. And it is notable to find that both the melodies associated with the Lersche texts are among those 12. And then there are 18 chorale settings, which if not by Bach himself, then certainly they come from his immediate circle. And they date, the interesting dates, 1507, 1526, 1531, 1541, 1544, 1575, 1585, so that there's quite a lot of the old stuff there. Then 1603, 1604, 1608, 1627, two of those, 1628, 1653, 1663, 1682, 1704, and one, 1733. So there are a number of interesting things about these melodies. For example, the many interesting things, but three of these melodies are associated with metrical psalms, one from Strasbourg, 1526, one from Geneva, 1542, and one from the Schutzbecker Psalter of 1628. Now, that is very interesting, the Schutzbecker Psalter, because by this time, we're into around 1740, by this time, the Schutzbecker Psalter is very dated, and not used in Leipzig, and not used in Dresden, though it had been used in Dresden right from 1628 through to the beginning of the 18th century. So interesting that it seems that Bach was concerned to be aware of hymnody in the widest possible sense. Now, if these chorales are authentic, and I'm inclined to believe that they are, this collection, then we would expect that they demonstrate that the Thomas Cantor had a continuing interest in every era of hymnody from the early 16th century to his own day. And since all these 32 settings are associated with less common texts, it implies that Bach was always seeking to widen hymnodic horizons, both of traditional hymnody and contemporary hymnody. Of the older hymnody that you find in these 32, they are off the beaten track, so we say. So he is concerned to widen his experience of older hymnody as he is concerned to widen his experience of newer hymnody. That is interesting. And further, as two-thirds of these associated texts, of the associated text of these 32 four-part settings, since they can be found in the Schemmelige Gesangbuch, perhaps this pencil collection contains a good many of the lost 200 from the Schemmelige melodies that Breitkopf had, albeit with their figured basses realized. And the eight associated with texts that don't appear in the Schemmelige Gesangbuch may well indicate that Bach continued collecting chorale tunes well after the Musikalisches Gesangbuch of Schemmelige 1736 had been published. So the state of play is, and there's a lot of research going on into the area of Bach and hymnody, but our picture of Bach and hymnody is being radically revised. The old picture was that he was stuck in the 16th century. The new picture, and more correct picture, is that yes, he was half stuck in the 16th century, but he was half stuck in his own world too, and was concerned to balance the best of the old with the best of the new. I guess it's time for a break.